It is time for the Media Beat with David Tarachuk. David joins us every Friday morning when we stop talking, that is. David, of course, has his own website, themediabeat.us. You can also see him on Huffington Post. He's also a PBS television correspondent reporting on ethics and belief. And as I said, when we finally be quiet, ladies and gentlemen, David Tarachuk, happy holidays.
Well, happy holidays to you. I'm so glad to be welcomed into your airwaves. I was waiting very patiently for you to bring me in.
Yeah, that happens nice to around be with here. You. It is nice to have you, and you are back from your travels. And
yep, I am back from my travels. I have a certain amount of jet lag, but I'll try and stay awake for the next 20 minutes. How about that?
I think that you will manage, because unless you are doing something else that we don't know about, falling asleep at about 1 in the afternoon really is mildly alarming, let's just say.
No, it's I'm on your time zone now. I am, absolutely. Okay. So it's early in the morning.
All right. So
at least in the media, down here in the media capital of the world, we are not expecting freezing rain. On the other hand, unlike you, we are also, we are not expecting what you're expecting on Christmas Day either. We are not due to have snow. I rather envy you.
Is that true?
We're not expecting snow on Christmas Day.
No snow in New York for Christmas?
Well, not so far. I mean, as you know, the weather forecasters can change on a dime, but right as of now, no, we're not expecting snow.
It might be rain in New York because it's a coastal storm.
Okay. Gotcha.
Aha.
Only because
a man who knows explains. Thank you. That's what I always want out of broadcasters. Thank you. A man who knows explains.
And apropos, that is a perfect segue and something that I would like to talk to you about after the show. But meanwhile, the man who knows explains. That's you. And under no, I'm dead serious.
Well, I'll step into that role willingly if it's anything I know about.
Well,
so
you'll have a week between shows to figure it out. And the first, we're kicking off the inaugural version of The Man Who Knows Explains on the Media Beat. And we're going to talk about a widely underreported story. And you can take it from there.
Oh, sure. I'd happily talk about things that are underreported. I think that's a very large part of my job. I mean, this has been a week where, another manic week, I guess, in American media. It's a week when coverage of the wider world by American media sources has been dominated, as usual, by America itself and America's leader himself, President Trump's decisions on Jerusalem, for instance. Less intense and attention. There was that was the dominating story of the week, I think, in international coverage in American media, Trump's decisions on Jerusalem. There was less intense attention for it in the follow-up period, the 14-1 condemnation of it by the UN Security Council and by the 128 out of 193 countries.
I thought they were expecting
the UN General Assembly.
Do you know what I heard? I heard they were expecting 160 to go against it, but then
a lot of countries decided not so much to
abstain.
They decided to either abstain or be absent. And it's very interesting. If you go down the list of the countries that either abstained or did the shilly-shally thing of just not showing up, you'll find an awful lot of countries that were indeed, it's arguable anyway, were in fact intimidated by Trump's threat to cut off American aid to those countries. I mean, the list is, you know, includes countries like South Sudan, which in its case wouldn't even exist if it wasn't for American assistance.
Did Trump just initiate that assistance? But weren't we going to talk about Mandela?
No, it was from a long time ago.
Yeah,
but,
so,
well,
I mean,
actually, from a long time ago in some people's terms, South Sudan is Africa's brand newest country. It dates from the Bush administration days, and it was the Bush administration that had a very large part in its creation. Sorry, I'm interrupting you now.
No, I was interrupting you because we are going to talk about Nelson Mandela.
Yeah, but because that was a real big. I mean, that was what the rest of the world believes is the biggest story of the week.
Right.
A very large part of it, anyway. I think it's almost an inverse lesson for us in South Africa this week. A manifestly corrupt president is turned against by his own political party. Notice, a party that's historically noble and high principled. Decided that it had enough of their leader, President Jacob Zuma. Now, he's still got a year and a half to run in his national presidency, his presidency of the country, but he is no longer the president of the party, and his favored nominee to succeed him, which is his own former wife, lost. And that, to that extent, at least, this is a massive rebuff for the president. And The conscience of the country, it seems pretty clear, has been running. excuse me, my jet lag extends to my throat.
It's
the conscience
all right.
of the country has been running to utter disgust for a long time now, and with the scales at party level tilted so differently now, Cyril Ramaphosa is a very different man from Zuma, and he is now the president of the party, and he has not an entire slate of immediate helpers sort of seconds in command and thirds in command who absolutely reflect his own views. He's hemmed in a little bit by some Zuma loyalists around him. But, as I say, the rebuff is very, very clear to the man at the top of the country, and it's perfectly possible now that the scales have been tilted that way that they could manage to organize through the parliament of South Africa a recall of the president. So that Zuma could end up being toppled before his term is fully up. Something of a lesson, I think, for how to handle a president that the country is sick of. His popularity ratings are way down in a sort of Trumpian level. So that's one to watch. But if you look historically at that story, what's so significant is that so many people are so appalled at this, as I say, the African National Congress being such a high-principled party historically, ever since it was formed in 1912, always non-racial, always very principled, not like so many liberation movements prey to internal divisiveness. Very non-racial, for instance, very important in African countries, yet somehow or other, it's the epitome of all that, as represented by all that high principle, is represented by Nelson Mandela, sunk so low in the two decades since Mandela was their first president. He was a different kind of president. He was a president who really didn't want to be president. I've just been looking at, we'll soon see in this country, publication of the second volume of his own memoir.
Yeah.
In it, there's a lot more detail coming out about how he argued with his party. But he was always a very loyal member of the party. 27 years in prison, and of course he couldn't effectively be their leader while in prison. And he described himself throughout all that time as a very humble servant of the party. And for most of that time he was, until he was given the right in prison to negotiate on behalf of his party. And then all sorts of stresses and strains got set up. But when he emerged, and he ended up, of course, leading the party again, he made it very clear to his colleagues that he did not want to be the country's president. That surprised them, or surprised some of them, of course, and it absolutely infuriated them, too. They needed a powerful and popular leader. And they insisted on him, and he became once again the humble servant of the party, and he became president. But he put a very strong condition on it. He said, "I only want to be a one-term president," and that's exactly what he turned out to be. As we know, presidents across the world can get into that position of ultimate power, and of course want to keep it, sometimes longer than the number of terms that they're allowed. That's quite a phenomenon through many parts of Africa now.
What is with that? Many
disputes. No. Well, I think it's called getting comfortable with being number one. Or it might be just that old English saying, I forget which member of the House of Lords said it, but you know, power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely.
Not
in the case of Mandela, though. He was allowed two terms. He wouldn't even take the two. He just wanted one.
And I think that that's really, it's just a reminder, really, really broad jump here, but that way back when, being a public servant was being a public servant, and you didn't do it forever and ever and ever and ever, amen. You did it for a certain amount of time, and then you went back to your life.
I remember a certain George Washington had to be persuaded into running for presidency too, and he didn't want to do it. He would have preferred to go to his farm, and that's indeed what he desperately wanted to do.
Well, and it's interesting how the so-called—I don't mean so-called in a negative way—but just the fathers of the countries wanted that, and the people who have taken it along the way have, you know, obviously, look. We have something happening right now. You can see when politics, when a decision is politically motivated. How's that for a diplomatic statement? You know, if you've got five brain cells moving around, you could pretty much see if any decision, is motivated by the politics of a situation or motivated by the objective or solution. It's a pretty clear delineation.
And often it's personal political ambition that you mean when you say politics. I mean, it's very interesting here in the media capital of the world. We're also just an ordinary town as well. We have a mayor, and our mayor was making a speech in Des Moines,
Iowa
this week. And
yeah, but
why would the mayor of New York be going to Iowa? That smacks of
it's like, well, that's an interesting
ambition,
choice. But and then...
Yeah. And it's remarkably easy to see that, of course.
But it's also remarkably easy to, the way that it's covered, which I find, you'll forgive me, incredibly annoying, is, oh, he's gone to Iowa. Oh, how political, but he denies any interest in politics. And it's like, well, that doesn't really help. that doesn't. You know, we sort of have to raise the... If we do want to re-engage people in actual news, you're going to have to raise the level of...
Treat the reader like all the listener. Or
two brain cells.
As a grown-up, perhaps, yeah.
Yeah. But you know, once it's founded, and I think this is, I mean, it was ever thus, you create something, and then as it is... as it evolves or as it is tooled, different people, you know, not everybody is operating, shall we say, for the greater good. There's a lot of, the best you can hope for sometimes is enlightened self-interest.
Right.
But in most cases, it's not terribly enlightened. And then when you throw the vast sums of money into it, you know, that becomes...
Sure, the vast sums of money are actually at the core of the particular downfall of, the moral downfall of the South African presidency of the moment. They have a very interesting word for it in South Africa. It's actually quite common throughout the developing world, but it's become used a lot repeatedly now in South Africa. It talks about corruption in a very particular way. The constant use of this phrase has been occasioned by the powerful inroads made into the fabric of South African public life by a particular family of businessmen and a whole network of companies that they own. The family is called Gupta. They're in fact from India originally. They're something of incomers into the South African business scene, but they've gained enormous capacity for a dominant position in the economy because of their connection with the presidency, with the president's own family, in fact, which is one of the reasons why his ex-wife was not elected to be his successor as the president of the party. A lot of the national disgust at the Zuma family is about their connections with the Gupta family. But to get around to the phrase that is used for this development, it's called state capture. The idea is that the very state itself is captured by financial interests, in this case the Gupta family and their associated businesses. And it's I think it speaks a lot of the true nature of corruption. You find that the democratic process is stolen and held hostage by other people who are not simply representatives, simply not members of the, not simple members of the society who have elected the officials. They are people with a different kind of influence on their political leaders. They've bought them, basically.
Right, bought and paid
for. That's the kind of corruption that you've got rampant in South Africa, and it is, thank goodness, the kind of corruption that they are now perhaps going to turn against under this new wave of disgust with what's been going on the last 6 to 10 years.
And just for fun, it should be said that promoting the Gupta family got a major PR firm in massive difficulty.
Oh, sure, absolutely. A British-based PR company that, again, had a very good reputation once upon a time. But, yeah, got themselves into a plan to modify public opinion in South Africa in such a way as would bring up old racial hatreds again. This by the faction of the ruling party, the one that has been so. I mean, it involved members of the ruling party at a high level, involved with President Zuma, and this again is the party that always had this long-standing reputation since 1912. Non-racial approaches to its policies in a country that was so dominated by racism from the white side.
And again, this information itself was not precisely covered in our press, although it was covered in
Every now and again. I mean, the actual vote was covered, of course, but the meaning of it all was. You had to look around carefully to find thoroughgoing and deep coverage of it. It's a shame because it is. It's kind of emblematic of lots of things. But it's. Just a ripping good story in its own right. If you're a journalist who's interested in the way power works.
I couldn't say that bit better myself. And in fact, a journalist should be interested in the way power works instead of just sort of knee jerking around it. Because there are, at the very least, once again, there are nuances that somebody has to convey. It is virtually the job of the conveyor to indicate that it's not yes, no, yes,
right.
No,
yeah,
no, yes, you're good. Horrible, you're good, and that's sort of what we've been, dieting on, feasting on.
It's thin gruel, I'm afraid. But the real substance lies in these complicated networks of influence, and sometimes it can be very simple. It's just simply that money talks. That's pretty simple. But other times it can be a complicated web of influence and payback, and you scratch my back and I'll scratch yours. But sometimes it's very carefully instituted in an institutional sense, which is what has been happening in South Africa. There are moves now. They have a wonderful there are moves now resulting from a wonderful office that they have in South Africa known as the Public Protector. Certain American cities have the Public Advocate and that kind of thing. This is the South African Constitution written in 1994, creates this position, and it was held recently by a wonderful woman who probed into the corruption around the Zuma family, in particular the use of public funds to create a very luxurious country home for the president and his family. But one of the recommendations from the Public Protector is that action can now be taken, should now be taken indeed, against the president. And we will see if the new party or the new leadership of the party is going to put its weight behind that. And I think there's a good chance that, given the mood of the country, that may well happen. And we will see a president that people are disgusted with toppled from his presidency before his term is out.
Thank you very much, David Tereshchuk, the Media Beat.
Thank you.